This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, North Korea's increasingly provocative behavior and U.S. deployment of an anti-missile system in South Korea. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. North Korea fired four ballistic missiles from its long-range rocket sites in the waters off its east coast on March 6th, the latest sign of Pyongyang's determination to push ahead with its missile program despite increasing international pressure against it. The launch prompted South Korean security officials to call for the early deployment of an advanced American missile defense system that has provoked China. The deployment of the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System, or THAAD, came after the North Korean missile launch. The missile launches coincided with the start of annual defense exercises between the United States and South Korea. North Korea conducted two unauthorized nuclear test explosions last year and nearly two dozen rocket launches in a continuing push to expand its nuclear weapons and missile programs. U.S. President Donald J. Trump spoke to South Korea's acting President Hwang by phone after the missile launches to reiterate U.S. support for its ally and reportedly emphasized the need to take strong measures to deal with North Korea's continued breach of U.N. Security Council resolutions. President Trump also called Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to reaffirm the U.S. alliance with Japan and condemn North Korea's tests as a threat to regional security. Meantime, China warns of consequences for South Korea and the United States over the THAAD missile deployment, further raising regional tension and posing a challenge to the Trump administration. With us to discuss the threat posed by North Korea's missile launch and the controversy surrounding the accelerated installation of the THAAD missile defense system in South Korea are two distinguished regional analysts. Bruce Klingier is a senior research fellow on Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation, and that's a policy group based in Washington, and Harry Kazianis. He's senior fellow for defense policy and senior editor at the National Interest, and that's a think tank also based here in Washington. And Harry Kazianis joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Bruce Klingier joins us by phone from Heritage Foundation. Welcome to you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, let me start with Harry Kazianis here in the studio. Harry, let's examine this recent missile launch by North Korea and the extent of their missile capabilities. How worried should the United States be and the rest of the world by this latest launch?
Well, I think we have to be very worried. I mean, I think this is a continuation of North Korean provocations that really has gone on for decades. The North Korean missile program really started in the mid to late 1970s. It's developed from very crude, Scud-like, short-range missiles, now moving to medium and now to possibly even long-range or intercontinental ballistic missile, a mouthful for saying missiles that could hit the United States, essentially. So I think we have to be very concerned. I will say I was very impressed that the Trump administration moved very quickly to deploy THAAD. Now, keep in mind, this will take about a month, probably longer, to get the system fully online. That takes a lot of time and a lot of preparation. But I think it's a bold move, and it shows where the Trump administration wants to go. They're not going to be filled with a lot of rhetoric on this issue. In fact, they've actually been very quiet. You haven't seen Donald Trump do a lot of tweets or anything like that lately. I think this is a bold move to sort of show that the United States is going to back its allies, it's going to be a strong partner, and it's going to put its money where its mouth is, essentially.
Turning to you, Bruce Klingier, at Heritage Foundation, for your reaction to the latest missile launches by North Korea and what it says about Kim Jong-un as a leader and where he's headed.
Well, as Harry pointed out, these tests of the four missiles sort of shows that North Korea can do a salvo launching of four at a time, and also that they landed in a pretty close area. So people are worried that it is an attempt to overwhelm missile defenses, such as the THAAD that we're now deploying. But it's also part of the overall trend. And last year, as you pointed out, we saw a very robust missile training program. In his 4 or 5 years in power, Kim Jong-un has done more than twice as many, perhaps three times as many missile launches as his father did in 18 years in power. And they're really the gamut of the missile capabilities. We think that the Scud extended range missiles that were fired, they can reach Japan. And North Korea announced that they were a practice of attacking U.S. bases in Japan. A Nodong missile, we think, is already nuclear capable. That puts Japan and South Korea under a nuclear threat today. They also had breakthroughs last year with their submarine launch missile, which puts South Korea at risk. It sort of exposes the flanks to attacks from the side. They also have a Musudan intermediate range missile, which again had a successful breakthrough. That puts U.S. bases in Guam at risk. And then they continue to work on both a fixed and a mobile ICBM, which can hit the United States. We think the missiles can already range the U.S., but they don't yet have a nuclear warhead. But North Korea has vowed they will test an ICBM anywhere, anytime.
Back to you here in the studio, Harry Kazianis. Both of you have affirmed support for this missile defense, THAAD. But we also know that China, who is an important bulwark against the nefarious activities of North Korea, is very much against it. So we need to discuss that. But first, talk about the purpose of THAAD. And is there actually unanimous consent in South Korea in favor of it, or is there controversy there as well?
Sure. Well, THAAD, it is not a silver bullet, but it is a good missile defense platform to take on short and medium range ballistic missiles that are in the terminal phase. What that essentially means is missiles that are coming down on a target. So this is not a missile defense system that could take out a long range or a missile that could hit the United States. So I think that's something important to keep in mind. In terms of South Korean public opinion, it's varied over the years. Actually, United States has tried to deploy THAAD really since early 2014, and it was requested by U.S. Forces Korea. So this is something I think that's been building for a long time. But I think the North Koreans are actually the ones to blame here, because there's been some hesitancy in South Korea to deploy the system. And when you have all of these multiple missile launches time after time, when you have nuclear test after nuclear test, when Kim Jong-un assassinates his brother with VX gas, there's going to be a response. There's no way you cannot have something to protect the South Korean people. So I think it was a very reasonable response and the prudent thing to do.
Back to you, Bruce Klingier. Is THAAD the prudent thing to do? Is it the right response, given the controversy it has engendered in China, whom we need in order to thwart and try to contain North Korea?
It's definitely the proper response. It's better than any system that South Korea has or will have for decades. Even a system that they still have on the drawing board won't be deployed for another decade is not as good as THAAD is today. So it improves not only the defense, but hopefully the deterrent capability of the allied forces against North Korea. So it better defends our forces that are there, as well as a large portion of the South Korean country. The controversy is because China is making it controversial. They claim that it will constrain their missiles and their ability to attack the United States or South Korea with missiles. It's not only false, it's disingenuous, and they know their technical claims are false. If you do the technical analysis, not only the interceptors of the THAAD, but the X-band radar, which is associated with, cannot see Chinese ICBMs if they decide to attack the United States, and it has no impact on Chinese missiles if they were to decide to attack South Korea. So it really is only able to defeat North Korean missiles. So China knows that. The U.S. and South Korea have repeatedly tried to provide technical briefings, and China rebuffs them because they know the answer. So they really are just trying to use this for political purposes to drive a wedge between the U.S. and South Korea. And the problem is China has been more willing to pressure South Korea for its defensive response than its ally North Korea for its offensive capabilities and its offensive actions.
Well, that's a very interesting point. Back to you, Harry Kazianis, here in the studio. If Beijing is so opposed to North Korea's provocative behavior, why do you think they are so vociferously against the deployment of THAAD? Why do they see it as a threat to them?
Well, you know what? I take a little bit longer view of this. I mean, we have to keep in mind that the United States and China have multiple pressure points between them, not just in North Korea that we're focusing on today. But we have to keep in mind the United States share tensions in the South China Sea, if you will. They share tensions over Taiwan. They share tensions in the East China Sea between the United States and Japan. So from talking to different Chinese colleagues I've had the pleasure to speak with over the last couple days, their worry is that this sets a precedent, that the United States will, in the months and years to come, if there are other crises, feel emboldened, feel that they'd be able to deploy more of these advanced missile defense platforms to other parts of the world. And I think for them, that sets a precedent that they don't want to see continue. I think it's very clear that in a military conflict, China would be able to defeat THAAD. They'd be able to overwhelm it with missiles. There's some debate that the North Koreans would probably be able to do the same thing. But it's the precedent that bothers them. The other thing that bothers them, too, is that the Chinese are very nervous that the types of radar that THAAD utilizes can be put in a long-range format to be able to basically gather intelligence about Chinese missiles and possible launches, as Bruce very skillfully pointed out. So I think it's the multitude of different challenges that we're seeing here. And when you put them all together, it creates great anxiety in Beijing.
Back to you, Bruce Klingier, before we go to a break. In addition to the fact that it sets a precedent in the view of China, as Harry Kazianis said, other arguments presumably advanced by Beijing are that the THAAD deployment encourages Pyongyang to pursue even more missile technology and that it is not necessarily susceptible to destruction by THAAD, and that it doesn't really deter or change North Korea's provocative behavior.
Well, the fallacy in China's thinking on that is that even without the U.S. deploying the system, North Korea has been on this path. They've been on the path since the 1960s when they started their quest for nuclear weapons. So they continue their building of nuclear weapons and missiles. You know, when we talk to them, when we don't talk to them, when we sign agreements with them to not pursue these programs. So it's just sort of a relentless quest. And China, unfortunately, has been part of the problem rather than part of the solution. In the UN Security Council, they act like North Korea's lawyer. They deny evidence of North Korea's violations. They insist on loopholes to make the international response less effective. They preclude stronger international responses. So really, as I said before, they're more willing to pressure and including economic embargoes and economic sanctions against South Korea more so than North Korea.
Which is very interesting. We're going to get to that after the break. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Bruce Klingier. He's Senior Research Fellow on Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation, from whom you just heard, and Harry Kazianis. He's Senior Fellow for Defense Policy and Senior Editor at the National Interest, a think tank based here in Washington. And we're discussing North Korea's provocative missile launches and the controversy surrounding the THAAD missile defense system, especially China's opposition to it. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Now here's a shout out to Kobe Boateng. He's a loyal fan from Koforidua, Ghana. I hope I said that right. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Harry Kazianis, here in the studio, to talk more about China's opposition to THAAD, even though presumably it would like to deter North Korea's behavior, and talk about these consequences, these threats that they're leveling against the United States and particularly South Korea, talking about consequences that they want to impose for South Korea's support for THAAD. How do you see that? What do you think they mean? Consequences?
Well, I mean, I think we're already starting to see the consequences. It's tough to tell whether it's directed by the Chinese central government or not. There are reports that say yes, some say no. But it's very clear that the Chinese are pushing different tourist groups and others to not go to South Korea. And obviously that has an economic impact. And that's a very hard thing for the South Koreans to swallow. But I think the important point is that this really shows an international pattern where China tries to push other countries to see things its way. And when it doesn't do that, Beijing becomes a bully. I think that's a tendency that we really have to watch out for because, again, that has repercussions in all the other pressure points in the U.S.-China relationship. So we have to really focus on that and think about what the long-term game is and something like that. So I think it's important. But I think the most important thing to keep in mind when it comes to Chinese policy towards South Korea, but also North Korea, is the Chinese love having North Korea as being basically a buffer between the U.S.-ROK alliance to the South. They do not want to see at any point in the near future South Korea reunify with Pyongyang and have a powerful Korean state. That is something I can tell you a lot of Chinese policymakers are very scared of, especially if those North Korean troops were to basically move north and move closer to the Chinese border. This is one of the reasons why the Korean War actually happened. So when you put all of these things together, it creates a melting pot that's very scary and it's going to be very tricky to navigate for the Trump administration in the future.
Turning back to you, Bruce Clenger, for your interpretation about why China continues to push back, try to punish South Korea. What other explanations do you have about their behavior? Do you see it similarly as Harry?
I think very much so. They're pushing the envelope on sovereignty claims in the South China Sea, have alienated Southeast Asian nations. They are looking to the U.S. for stronger sort of freedom of navigation operation exercises. They're looking for greater support from the United States because they're worried about Chinese behavior. And if they feel that the U.S. is not there, either in military capabilities or resolve, then that would lead those nations to perhaps consider more accommodating or balancing tactic with Beijing. You know, we've seen in the past with South Korea and Japan this sort of belligerent behavior by China when there was a incident in 2010 between Japan and China over islands which are controlled by Japan called the Senkakus, but which are claimed by China. Then China cut off export of rare earth minerals, and in a way similar boycotts of Japanese products as they're now doing to South Korean firms, and taking measures such as increasing safety inspections, etc. So they were willing to take an economic hit themselves in order to prove a point to Japan.
Back to you, Harry Kazianis. Here in the studio, China has also threatened the United States, warned of consequences. What might those be for the United States?
Well, I think here we start to move into more dangerous ground. I mean, it's tough to envision what those consequences would be, but I'll speculate for a moment. I mean, there could be other things that China could do in the East China Sea, for example, maybe pushing against Japan. There might be some things they could do to push harder in the South China Sea, maybe building up their islands further or trying to do some things to chip away at freedom of navigation, which is something the United States is very worried about. But I think the point is here is China would be vastly overplaying its hand if it did something like that. I will tell you with firsthand knowledge, the Trump administration is filled with many different senior staffers, experts that really want to get tough on China, not just on the strategic realm, but also in the economic realm. You have folks like Peter Navarro and others who have basically written large books and done a lot of research on this type of thing, and they're itching to push back on China. So I think Beijing would be making a huge strategic mistake to make any sort of actions that would sort of endanger the U.S.-China relationship over North Korea. And we have to keep in mind, the United States has a lot of different ways to push back, different avenues in trade that we could push back. There's a lot of things that we can do to enhance our own military capabilities in the Asia-Pacific that I know this administration's actively looking at. So I think China's playing with fire here, and I think it would be a very dangerous, provocative move.
What do you think, Bruce Clenger, over there at the Heritage Foundation? What consequences do you think China has in mind for the United States, and how should the U.S. react? Because we recall President Trump saying that we need China in order to contain North Korea, but it doesn't seem they're doing that, that they're actually punishing, as you said, South Korea for the deployment of THAAD. So it's a very dicey situation.
Exactly. And we don't know what China's intentions are. Is it just bluster to try to cause the U.S. to either retract or delay its deployment of the full THAAD system? You know, would they take economic actions against U.S. companies, precluding them from bidding in China? Would they increase troubles to U.S. firms, such as increasing inspections or extending, you know, government actions against them? So, you know, whether it's an economic basis or whether it's sort of a more military focus, as some of the options Harry was talking about, you know, we don't know. But as Harry pointed out, this administration, I think, will be far more likely to respond firmly to China, sort of given the characteristics and the viewpoints of the people advising Mr. Trump. There's going to probably be less likelihood of, oh, let's tone down any responses so as not to sacrifice the important strategic relationship. Instead, it may be, if China does this, we will respond accordingly. So it's the uncertainty, the unpredictability, not only of China's actions, but how the new Trump administration will respond vis-a-vis China and vis-a-vis North Korea that have raised concerns and tensions in the region.
Back to you, Harry Kazianis, in the studio. We know that North Korea consistently evades sanctions with the help of a vast network of front companies and governments. So on the sanctions front, what can we do, the United Nations and other international states, to try to push back on North Korea and get them to change their behavior?
Easy answer, enforce them. And I think Bruce would agree with me on this because he's done some great work on this, so he'd be the pro to ask on this one. But I would humbly submit to you that there's a lot of sanctions on the books that the United Nations Security Council has passed. And the challenge is most of the trade with North Korea goes through China. So we're basically stuck because if all of the different trade and all of the different resources that North Korea sells is going through China, there isn't a lot that we can do besides try to insist that these different resolutions are enforced. Now, the Obama administration also had a track record where sometimes they wouldn't be as tough as enforcing a lot of these different sanctions. But I think those are two things that we can sort of push on very, very quickly. The other thing I would submit to you is that we must do everything that we can to ensure that North Korea is completely locked out of the financial system. This is something we were very good at that we did to Iran when we kicked Iran out of the SWIFT system, which is basically a fancy acronym for all the different ways that banks exchange financials and money and those type of things. And actually, North Korea, three different banks from North Korea were actually just kicked out of SWIFT. We need to make sure that North Korea has no access to the financial system and also no access to hard currency. We need to make sure that they aren't able to buy the weapon systems, the spare parts, the resources, the luxury goods that the regime wants. We need to do everything that we possibly can to strangulate North Korea. I think it's only when you do those things and you do them effectively, you'll bring North Korea to the table, but you also bring China to the table.
Do we need China to enforce these very sanctions that you're talking about?
We absolutely do. And I think it's a stretch to imagine that they are going to put tremendous pressure on their ally. But keep in mind, they do not want to see North Korea collapse. But at the same time, we have to try and work with China to bring them to the table, because we do not want a situation here someday where North Korea continues these different missile tests and one lands in Japan or one lands in South Korea. Because I guarantee you, if anybody is hurt or killed, either one of those countries would respond.
Bruce Klingier, what do you have to add or subtract to trying to put more pressure on North Korea through sanctions, enforcement thereof?
As Harry said, the first step is actually implement them, use all the existing authorities. And there was a bipartisan congressional frustration with the Obama administration's unwillingness to use all the authorities he had, what I call timid incrementalism. Last year, the main actions that the Obama administration took against North Korea were all required that he do so under a new congressional law. It was only last year that the U.S. cumulatively sanctioned as many North Korean entities as it had Zimbabwe entities. And when people think of sanctions, they tend to think of trade sanctions, and because the U.S. doesn't trade with North Korea, they feel that there's no impact. What we're actually talking about are called targeted financial measures, and that's based on the idea that because the vast majority of all international financial transactions in the world, including those of North Korea, are denominated in dollars, it means they have to go through a U.S. bank. And that gives us tremendous leverage over North Korea, as well as the Chinese entities that are dealing with North Korea. And what we saw in the past was when we did secondary sanctions against those that were helping North Korea, it induced the Bank of China to defy the government of China and cut off its engagement with North Korea, lest it face U.S. sanctions. So if we were to go after the Chinese violators of U.S. law, we can either pick them off or influence them away from engaging with North Korea, kind of regardless of what the Chinese government wants.
And as we close, gentlemen, back to you, Harry Kazianis. We read by midweek that the Chinese came up with some kind of a compromise proposal proposing that North Korea suspend its nuclear and missile activities in exchange for the U.S. and South Korea halting their joint military drills. Do you see that as even viable?
No, not at all. We talk a lot about these days about fake news. That's a fake plan, in my opinion. I mean, look, there's no way that the United States and South Korea are going to stop doing military exercises, which is something that all countries do and is a completely normal thing. We telegraph them, we record them, we take lots of pictures of them. To the militaries around the world, that is not a provocative act. That's training. That's what militaries do. And there's no way that the United States is going to trade that, or South Korea is going to trade that, to basically legitimize all the bad things that North Korea has done in terms of its missile testing and nuclear programs. We're basically saying it's okay for you to have those weapon systems. And that's going to be a signal to other countries like Iran, to other bad state actors that are out there, that it's okay to do these things, that at the end of the day, you'll get away with it. And that's something we absolutely cannot do.
The last word to you, Bruce, on this Chinese proposal.
Yeah, it's actually simply a North Korean talking point. North Korea made the same offer in January of 2015 and other times. And North Korea is offering something it doesn't legally possess. It's already precluded from doing nuclear and missile tests according to the UN resolutions. And it's demanding the U.S. give up its exercises, which we're not precluded from. We're allowed to do those. And North Korea also doesn't even mention its ongoing winter training cycle, which all these missile launches are part of that exercise that North Korea does. So they could offer up those exercises in return for our exercises. At least that would be comparing apples and apples.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Bruce Klinger, he's Senior Research Fellow on Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation, and Harry Kazianis, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy and Senior Editor at the National Interest. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Kelvin Fowler. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.